And good evening. Welcome to Corporations and Democracy for Thursday, May 21st, 2025. This is, 2026. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scaminini with co-host Annie Esposito. In today's program, we have an opportunity to discuss the legal maneuvering going on in the courts regarding the fundamental right to vote and have everyone's vote count in the same meaningful way regarding the districts in which they vote. And with us is the Vice President for Voting Rights and the Rule of Law at Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. That's Danielle Lang. She works in one of the organizations that is doing the suing to ensure that all voters' rights are protected, a task that is becoming more difficult as the result of court decisions in recent years and even in recent weeks. Danielle has worked as a civil rights litigator for her entire career and as a voting rights litigator for over a decade. At CLC, she has led dozens of case teams challenging state and federal laws and policies that unlawfully restrict access to the ballot. She founded CLC's unique Restore Your Vote project. She also serves as an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, where she co-teaches the election law practicum. She is a 2012 graduate of Yale Law School after a bachelor's degree from New York University. She's a member of the bars of the, gotta take a long breath here, District of Columbia, New York and Pennsylvania, as well as the bars of the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 1st, 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, 9th, and 11th circuits, and the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. And with that, she's got me beat for sure. So, with that, let's take a look at what is next for voting rights and the right to vote after the demise of the Voting Rights Act and in light of recent other legal decisions. Welcome to Corporations and Democracy, Danielle Lang.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to get into it with you all.
Yeah, you know, right now with our democracy under assault, one of the things that we can do to save it is to fight it in the courts. And so that's one thing that the Campaign Legal Center is doing, and you're heading that up beautifully in the courts all the time. So thank you for being there and helping to do one of the things on the list to save the democracy. Do you want to talk a little bit about your organization?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ultimately, I think the voters are going to be the ones that save our democracy. But I think of our job at Campaign Legal Center as making sure that we safeguard the processes that will let voters do that and that make sure that voters' voices are heard. So Campaign Legal Center is an election law nonprofit based here in D.C., but working across the country on all issues of election law. So from kind of at the voter right to know phase, looking at campaign finance and making sure that voters understand who is financing campaigns, to voter access. And that's been a long focus and passion of mine. And, you know, how do we get to the ballot? How do we make sure everyone can get to the ballot box equally, to representation and how do we draw the districts that kind of aggregate our votes and decide how we pick our representatives, to ethics in government after our elected officials are chosen and are serving. How do we hold them to account, to ethical standards? So we use legal tools, and advocacy tools, across all those spectrums, to protect our democracy and advance our democracy.
So one of the very kind of discouraging things that came down was ripping apart of the Right to Vote Act. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court?
Yes. It has been a difficult season, I would say, for voting rights litigators. And so let me start by backing up introducing voters or listeners, perhaps, to the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, whether you know it or not, is, you know, the creator of our modern democracy. You know, prior to 1965, you know, Black Americans in the South largely couldn't vote. And that was largely a state of affairs that had been permitted to go on despite the 14th and 15th Amendments for, you know, many decades. But with the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, we really ushered in a real democracy for the first time in the United States history. And it had a couple of key components. And one of them is what we call Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act that, you know, bars discrimination in voting. And the Supreme Court, so Congress had passed this law. And then at some point, the Supreme Court, had kind of gutted it by saying, the Voting Rights Act isn't going to do anything more than prohibit what the 14th and 15th Amendments prohibit. Only intentional racial discrimination. And Congress went back and amended the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to say, no, we meant to provide more protections. We meant to change the state of affairs to make it a more equal democracy. And in 1982, amended the Voting Rights Act to make it very, very clear that it wanted to protect voters from discriminatory results in our election procedures. And what came of that, was, the birth of, you know, representation in the South, for many Black voters, that they had not previously had. What did that look like? It looked like, for example, in Alabama, them not being able to draw all the districts in a way that white voters would be able to wash out the impact of Black voters in every one of those districts, that instead they would have to draw a district where, you know, Black voters who are a substantial population would be able to actually elect a candidate of their choice. And that is, you know, the kind of Congress that you and I are all used to kind of seeing, one in which there's meaningful Black representation from the South, to represent that sizable population. And that brings us to today. Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the events of the last few weeks, in which, in a court case called Calais, the Supreme Court has taken us back, to pre-Voting Rights Act, Jim Crow type representation in the South. It has held, it gutted Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and made it such that none of those districts, that were, drawn to give Black voters a voice in their Congress have to be drawn anymore. And unfortunately, what we've seen is legislatures in the South that can't act quickly enough to decimate those districts now that the Supreme Court has unleashed them to do so. You know, Louisiana went so far as to suspend an ongoing primary election. It was already happening. This is an election that was already happening. And they said, well, forget about it. Throw out all those voters' votes. We're going to redraw the districts, so that we can get rid of this district that would represent the Black population.
Was it the governor that said the E word? It's an emergency.
Yes, it was an emergency. Mm-hmm. The emergency was that Black voters were going to have fair and equal representation in Louisiana. And Alabama and Tennessee, have both followed suit, pushing to change their districts as well. And so we are seeing very quickly the fallout of this decision from the Supreme Court. Absent the protections of the Voting Rights Act, it is still the case that legislatures in the South would happily draw districts where Black voters will never be able to elect their candidates of choice. If it's up to them, that's what they would choose to do.
Mm-hmm. So we have this double gerrymandering thing going on where they had already started that overt gerrymandering with Texas, followed by the answer from California. And then along comes Louisiana versus Calais. And then that's permission to redraw more districts to lock out more black people who are presumed to vote Democrat, I guess, is the big problem. So now what I guess there are some states that are trying to come up with state voter rights acts to win back democracy in some places.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So we have long been working on state voting rights acts at Campaign Legal Center, and think that they're a really important tool, because even before this most recent decision, the Supreme Court had kind of diminished the power of the Voting Rights Act in a variety of ways over a series of decisions. So this was just the most recent and perhaps most fatal blow to the Voting Rights Act. But, you know, the Supreme Court has been on this project of decimating the Voting Rights Act for quite some time. And so states are standing up and saying, no, we're going to take matters into our own hands. We're going to protect voting rights access at the state level. And those state level voting rights acts can do a bunch of different things. They can address certain issues around redistricting and representation. They can also address, you know, questions of voter access and language access, and kind of go to a broad set of protections for people of color and their access to the ballot and their access to representation.
Mm-hmm. So you want to talk a little bit about this tornado of redistricting, and then we can get into some of the other attacks on our voting, of which there's many more. Let's see, we have a lot of redistricting battles going on in California and Texas and everywhere, right? Virginia, 4 seats at stake, Florida, 4 more.
It turns out not easy to find which ones are quote-unquote settled or which ones are still in litigation. So
yeah, no, it's hard. It's dizzying. And let me step back. I'm happy to give the the kind of details on a bunch of the different states. But, you know, I also want to step back and give voters the big picture, which is, once again, the Supreme Court. Lay the blame a little bit at the Supreme Court, which in a case that, you know, CLC, Campaign Legal Center, litigated, the court, you know, set legislatures free to gerrymander on partisan basis, right? It used to be that, you know, there was some question, at least, about how far you could go in trying to cook the lines in favor of your party. And I think that had a restraining effect. But after the Supreme Court said, no, we are definitely never going to punish you for partisan gerrymandering. You can do it to your heart's content. That's what we've seen. And that's not what voters want. We know that that's not what voters want. And yet that's what we've seen. And so in 2026, in an election year where voters should be focused on, finding the candidates that best represent them. Candidates should be focusing on understanding what voters want from them and trying to represent their interests in the election year. Instead, we're focused on how can we draw the lines so that it's not about persuading voters. It's about kind of gerrymandering the results, trying to create foreordained results instead of actually trying to persuade the voters.
Yeah. Do you think there's a legal argument against what Louisiana did by stopping in mid-election, throwing out the votes, and then starting over?
I absolutely think that there is. Whether or not, you know, and there's on, you know, the ACLU and others sued immediately about this. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they have not yet, you know, had success in stopping it. But if you think about it for even a moment, it's once an election starts, a state should not be allowed to kind of throw out those votes and say, "Yep, we want to do it a different way." That's not what democracy is. You know, anybody who plays sports knows that you're supposed to have a set of rules, and when you go to play the game, you play by those rules. You don't say, "Oh, wait, I actually came up with some different rules that I think would be better for me. So let's stop this game, and I'd like to start a new one." And yet, I think that's what we've seen this cycle, and coming to the most extreme example in Louisiana, where we were actually already in an election.
Mm-hmm. It must be breathtaking to be in the law profession and see a complete flouting of rule of law. It's just it's like the very top administration doesn't even care about rules. It's very, very strange. One thing that I was, Steve, did you want to say?
Well, I believe Supreme Court Justice Roberts has said, well, we have a colorblind society now.
Oh, good.
Which, of course, is why all these states are racing to redistrict. I wonder if anyone's asked him about that in public, but, I have a somewhat a detailed question to ask about this whole idea of gerrymandering or not gerrymandering, and exactly what the Supreme Court said. You know, the actual words they use may be relevant here, but in the case of Louisiana, for example, I believe that the lawsuit filed against the Voter Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, in this case, was over whether a second district could be created in a state that was majority minority and majority black, in this case, in the state of Louisiana. And that would have been two of their congressional districts would have been majority black. And they were sued about for that second one. And they both got overturned. I mean, they're both being gerrymandered out right now. My question is, in the eyes of the court, do you happen to know if it's even considered a gerrymander at all? If the population represented, like in this case, two congresspeople in a majority minority district, two out of, I don't know how many they have, don't have that detail with me, six or eight, whatever it might be. But if the percentage of congressional representatives, you know, two out of six, eight, ten, is less than the population of the minorities, because it's like 30 or 40% black in the state of Louisiana, why would that even be a gerrymander? It doesn't give them an advantage. They still don't have an advantage, still an advantage of the other districts, but.
I think that's exactly how most Americans would think about it, right? This is about a question of fairness and representation, mm-hmm. right? That if you are a group of voters, whether that's black voters or a certain party or whatnot, if you represent a certain bloc that vote together, you should get representation that, you know, somewhat accords with that kind of your share of the population. Maybe it's not always going to shake out exactly perfectly. We don't have like a proportional representation system per se, but that we should have something that looks like fairness. Mm-hmm. And if it's something that looks like fairness, then you wouldn't call that a gerrymander. That's unfortunately not really the way that the Supreme Court has addressed questions of election law. Instead, the Supreme Court has said that legislators can do everything in their power to make representation unfair. They have the right to partisan gerrymander, and they can do it to their heart's content. And when it comes to considering race and redistricting, rather than thinking about questions of fairness and representation and whether or not voters that, you know, if black voters vote together, which is not always the case, but in Louisiana it is, if you can show that they're a kind of coalition, that they get to have representation, instead of thinking about it that way, what the Supreme Court has said is, you shouldn't look at race at all. You shouldn't look at the race of voters at all in drawing these districts. And by purposefully drawing a district that would allow black voters an ability to elect candidates of choice that was improperly considering race under the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really, I think it's a quite a perversion of the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment and what they stood for in Reconstruction to say that the real kind of violation of the Reconstruction Amendments is to construct a district that would allow Black voters in Louisiana to have their voices heard. Mm-hmm. And yet that is exactly what the Supreme Court held.
Yes.
That is the violation. That is the 14th Amendment violation, is if you constructed a district expressly for the purpose of enabling Black voters' voices to be heard, and in proportion, not, you know, in excess of their that is a violation of the 14th Amendment. And that's where we sit. And I think that's outrageous. And I think it would strike most Americans as outrageous. And it's going to require a response. It's going to require a response from the voters. It's going to require a response from Congress to say that is not what our constitutional values stand for, and that we want a democracy that really represents all corners of our country and represents the diversity of our country.
Do you think some of the gerrymanders in Texas, for example, will backfire because when they cut out, you know, a certain kind of voter from one place where they crack and pack and all that, they are diluting the districts that they had before that were like solid, and they're weakening them a little bit. And then when you lose, perhaps MAGA might lose some of its Latino vote. Do you think that some of that gerrymandering might end up not working for them? They might end up actually electing a Democrat.
So I want to step back and, you know, what you're describing there is what we sometimes call the dummy mander, right? There's this concept in election, you know, election law and political science of the dummy mander, which is you can be seeking to get a lot of partisan advantage, but if you cut it too close and you try to get as much advantage as humanly possible, you could be kind of subject to, you know, when there are big swings in the electorate, your gerrymander doesn't hold, right? And I don't know how it'll shake out in this election cycle in, you know, states, the Democratic states or Republican states, Texas or California. But what I can say is that I think it's important. What that concept tells us is that at the end of the day, partisan gerrymandering, racial gerrymandering, all this kind of playing with the lines is really harmful to our democracy. It can make voters feel unheard. But at the end of the day, the voters still do have a lot of power. And if they speak together, you know, no amount of line drawing can silence them. And I think that's, you know, the bigger picture that I want folks to remember, because I know that folks can feel like things seem hopeless when our elected officials are saying, don't worry about voting. We'll take care of the lines. We'll decide who's going to get elected. And it's important for voters to know that, you know, they don't hold all the power. Mm-hmm. You know, voters, there's a reason why elected officials are so focused on trying to like negotiate the rules in their favor. And it's because they know that ultimately at the end of the day, it's voters who decide.
Mm-hmm. That emphasizes all the more the showdown coming in November, and we'll see what the majority of voters want to do. And by the way, speaking a couple of minutes ago about, you know, cracking and packing diminishing the, I'll call it Republican majority, since this is so partisan in this particular era. The Republican majorities are shrunk in some areas in order to move Republican voters in some of the districts that used to be Democratic majority. And in light of that, we know that for the last, it's been around a year now, that elections have been swinging about, you know, 10 points or more toward the Democrats. in all the, you know, special elections that have happened in the last year. So it speaks for the possibility of a backfire coming in November. Time will tell, but, you know, some of the data does point to that being a possibility.
Not my job to prognosticate on what the voters are going to choose, but yeah. I think it is for voters know that they get to make the choice at the end of the day.
Did you want to give out numbers in case there's questions?
Yeah, right. We're at the bottom of the hour quickly. If you'd like to get a call in here to Danielle Lang, she's Vice President for Voting Rights and Rule of Law at Campaign Legal Center in Washington. And we're speaking about the issue of what's next for voting rights and after the demise of the Voting Rights Act, which was just a few weeks ago. I think April 29th was that decision from the Supreme Court. Decision, I think, is detestable, but nonetheless, that is the law for the time being. Again, 895-2448 if you'd like to get in a call or comment on the air.
Another thing that we're seeing a lot of right now that's crazy making is it seems like the government wants to grab all the ballots and all the voter information. They're I guess a DOJ has sued 30 states and Washington, D.C., and there was a candidate for governor in California who just went and grabbed some ballot boxes out of the district where he votes. What's going on with that? I'm sure the campaign for Campaign Legal Center has a lot to work with trying to fight back some of this invasion of the voters' information.
Yes, I can understand how, you know, all of this news is probably makes voters feel very uneasy. So let me try to make listeners feel a little more at ease, which is it is true that the Department of Justice is trying to get four states to hand over, you know, voter data for their purposes. They've sued 30 states and they are 0-8 on succeeding in those lawsuits.
All right.
Before judges appointed from both parties, from, you know, judges appointed by President Trump himself, all have thrown out these lawsuits, unanimously. So, you know, they can file lawsuits. They can try to assert power that they don't have over our elections. And they will do that. They are doing that and they will do that. At the end of the day, our constitutional structure is actually very clear about this, which is that the federal government, and especially the president has no role to play in our elections. Elections are run at the state and local level. Congress can set rules for those elections, but there's no role for the president to play in setting the rules or trying to, you know, conduct what is essentially voter registration reviews by looking at all these voter list data. Yeah,
you just beat me to the punch here on the 0-8 figure that you mentioned, because that news is
quite over here. We've intervened in a number of these cases. You know, we were involved in the main case that actually came, the decision came out today.
Yeah, so, just today.
We were celebrating over here a victory and, you know, ready to go on to the next one.
Yeah, great. Glad to hear it. Let me mention a few things out of the article that came out mid-afternoon today. Again, I said it's 4.5 hours ago. This is from a U.S. District Judge Lance Walker. This is regarding Maine. He said, whatever investigatory purposes may support a Title III records demand, voter list maintenance is not among them.
Yes.
So this is where go ahead.
Yeah, it's just the claims being made by the administration here are just pretty ludicrous, right? Mm-hmm. They're trying to use a part of the Civil Rights Act. Once again, a Civil Rights Act of 1965 that was about protecting the Voting Rights Act of Black voters and making sure that the federal government could access the data they needed in order to enforce civil rights mandates, mm-hmm. and trying to use that as a way to hoover up all of the voter data in the, across the entire country so that they can, you know, do voter eligibility checks. Mm-hmm. That is so far afield from what the Civil Rights Act was envisioning.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and the databases that the federal government is using are reportedly, from many sources, extremely inaccurate, out of date, and a problem that you're continually removing or indicating people are not citizens who are. And
that's exactly the issue that we've been seeing for quite some time now. You know, and so I want to make something really plain. Nobody is interested in having non-citizens voting, mm-hmm. Least of which non-citizens, which is to say, you know, only U.S. citizens can vote. Those rules are clear. That's the way that our elections have been run for a very long time, and successfully so. But what we do know is happening is that these new data sources that folks are trying to use to vet the voter rolls, they're not finding non-citizens on the rolls. They're finding naturalized U.S. citizens on the rolls, mm-hmm. and then targeting them for discrimination. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is kind of obvious once you know a little bit about how these systems work, which is none of our data sources in this country are like completely up to date or completely, you know, data gets collected when there's a reason to collect it, right? Data sources are usually just snapshots in time, right? So the Social Security database, for example, does have some citizenship information, but it's just a snapshot in time from when you applied for your Social Security number. Mm-hmm. Were you a citizen at that time? Now, I was born in the United States. I've always been a citizen. So none of those snapshots in time are going to suggest I'm not a citizen, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if I have a friend who's a naturalized citizen, some of those snapshots in time from data sources are going to suggest she's not a citizen because she wasn't at some point in the past. Ordinarily legal permanent residents get their Social Security numbers before they become citizens at the time that they're legal permanent residents, and then they naturalize. The Social Security Administration doesn't update that information when somebody naturalizes. And so whenever you're looking at data sources that are just snapshots in time around citizenship, what you're going to end up doing is really targeting naturalized U.S. citizens, because those are the people who are going to have these stale data problems, and they're going to be kind of targeted for removal. And then, of course, these voters feel, these are folks that come from immigrant communities. And so, but they are U.S. citizens. They worked hard for that citizenship, unlike the rest of us, honestly. They worked really hard to get that status. And they take the privilege of voting very seriously. But it's really scary sometimes when they're being accused of, you know, wrongdoing, of voting when they shouldn't be.
One thing that made me jump up was that Campaign Law Center had to come to the rescue of the League of Women Voters, because they have kind of a program to go to a citizenship swearing-in ceremonies and then register people to vote. And I guess now the government is trying to prevent the League of Women Voters from registering new citizens to vote.
Yeah, you heard that right. So for decades in many places, the League of Women Voters has been steadfastly attending naturalization ceremonies. And, you know, standing, they often are there with like little, U.S. flags, and they have their forms, yeah. And they're nonpartisan, and they just welcome everybody with a packet of information about how to vote and help them get registered. And it is really this like incredibly heartwarming exercise. And they've never had any problems with it. They've always been kind of welcomed by USCIS, which is the agency that does these swearing-in ceremonies. It's always been a really kind of positive experience. And then with like basically no warning last year, the administration announced that they decided that groups like the League can no longer attend naturalization ceremonies for the purposes of voter registration activities. Full stop.
One more time. Who decided that? What organization?
the Trump administration, specifically the Department of Homeland Security. So DHS is the agency that runs USCIS, which is the agency that oversees all of the citizenship ceremonies. And so it was the Department of Homeland Security that announced that no longer would the League of Women Voters and, you know, similar nonpartisan groups be welcome at naturalization ceremonies to help folks register to vote. And I truly, so we have filed a lawsuit challenging that on a number of bases, primarily on First Amendment grounds. It is the League's right to go there and kind of promote civic engagement. That is poor political speech of the best kind, right? It's not about who to vote for. It's just about telling people to vote. And to try to silence the League when they're just trying to, you know, welcome new citizens and kind of promote their equal participation in our democracy, I think is really shameful. We're awaiting a decision from the district court there. But I was in the courtroom when we had the argument about this case, and the government just had no reasons, none. You know, the government was like, oh, it might be administratively easier to not have them there. even though they couldn't put forward any evidence, for example, that it had ever caused them any administrative inconvenience for them to be there. It was quite a sight to see the government try to defend a decision to shut out nonpartisan civic engagement groups from welcoming new citizens into our democracy, and hardly put up a fig leaf as to why.
Is that resolved though? Is that still in court then?
It's not. We're waiting for a decision, you know, hopefully any day now. We're very hopeful that, we will, get some relief from the court, so that the League, ladies can get back to work, especially during election cycle, which is an important time for them to be making sure that everybody gets registered to vote.
Indeed. Speaking of the League of Women Voters, and let me get to that in a moment, let me remind listeners first, though, we're speaking with Danielle Lang. She's the Vice President for Voting Rights and Rule of Law at the Campaign Legal Center. And we're talking about what's next and what the current status is for the maintaining voting rights, trying to maintain voting rights. After the demise of the Voting Rights Act, just was it almost 3 weeks, about 3 weeks ago. And if you want to call in here with any comments or questions, the number is area code 707-895-2448. And back to the League of Women Voters, there's a list here of some of your activities at Campaign Legal Center. In one of the recent articles that was just a couple of weeks ago, it's titled, "The Trump Administration's Attempts to Get Sensitive Voter Data Threaten the Rule of Law." But some of the examples I want to mention, just I'll go quick here. In Maine, Campaign Legal Center and the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law successfully intervened and filed a motion to dismiss on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Maine. Now, that's one of the actions to maintain the voter data. In New York, Campaign Legal Center and the Brennan Center for Justice, again, filed a motion to intervene and a motion to dismiss on behalf of the League of Women Voters of New York State. In Vermont, Campaign successfully intervened and filed a motion to dismiss alongside the Brennan Center, again, on behalf of the Vermont Public Interest Research Group. That's Vermont PIRG, P-I-R-G, for people that use those acronyms. In Washington, Campaign Legal Center filed a motion to intervene with the Brennan Center on behalf of Common Cause and Washington Conservation Action Education Fund. And I won't go the details of the others, but they are in Oregon, including the Women of League of Voters, League of Women Voters of Oregon, in New Hampshire with the ACLU of New Hampshire and the League of Women Voters of New Hampshire. And there's three more after that. So I hope you'll accept my compliments for working with a broad range of other organizations, getting the right things done for voter and voting rights around the nation.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I will say it is a great privilege of this work to work with so many other folks that are so dedicated to making our democracy work. And you know, legal partners like the Brennan Center are, like, you know, so important to us being able to, none of us can do it alone. All of us have to do it in partnership. And I feel like as the threats to our democracy have become, more stark, I have also noticed, the resolve of this community to only be stronger. And so it's been a great privilege to work with our legal partners. And then, but more importantly, the clients, like when I get to represent the League of Women Voters in all these different states, or, conservation voters or Common Cause, like these are folks that are, grassroots folks, really just bringing together their neighbors to participate. And so I do the work in the courts, so that they can do the real work of democracy, which has to be at the grassroots. And so I'm so inspired by them every day. I'm no good at the organizing piece, but they're very good at it. And I'm just grateful that I can do my part in supporting them in the courts.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
I'll put in a quick plug for in California, you were active and you were working with the Democracy Defenders Fund and League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC.
LULAC, okay.
Yeah, we represent LULAC a lot as well, and they are a really extraordinary group, the oldest and largest Latino civic engagement group in the country, civil rights group in the country.
Now, there does seem to be a lot of federal action here that's not strictly legal, and there is Trump signed an executive order against mail-in ballots. Can he do that? I mean, he did do that.
I mean, he can sign a piece of paper. President Trump can sign any number of pieces of paper that say he orders any number of things. But that doesn't change the kind of constitutional structure of our election rules. And he just doesn't have any power over mail ballots. And I am, confident that at the end of the day, this executive order will not amount to much more than a signature on a piece of paper when it comes to mail voting. I have to believe that that's true if the rule of law will prevail. The executive order seeks to tell USPS that it should kind of create its own list of who should get mail ballots. It's not clear how they would create such a list, but whatever list they create, that then they should not deliver ballots to anyone not on that list. Neither USPS nor the president have those types of powers. Mail ballot rules are set by the states, and they are administered by local elections. And there is a law that requires the Postal Service to deliver all mail, except for in very specific categories, of which mail ballots that they don't like is not one of those categories. So, they are required to deliver all mail, except for, very specific categories of mail. And so they have to do so. And I was recently in court arguing against this executive order. And there have been a lot of procedural arguments about the case and its current posture and what's happening with it or whatnot. And those are pretty technical and legal. But the judge did turn at some point to the Department of Justice lawyer and say, I know you have all these procedural arguments as to why you think plaintiffs should lose right now, et cetera. but what's your best argument that you can actually do this? And he said, I can't answer that because you know, we have to get through all these procedural requirements first. And, you know, the judge said, normally, you know, I hear these kinds of cases about you're challenging an executive action all the time. And normally at some point, the lawyer, the government lawyer gets around to telling us why they can actually do this. and notably, you have not done so here. And I think that's really telling. There is no way that the president can order the Postal Service to not deliver ballots that states are trying to send out to their voters. There's just no lawful way for them to do that. And so we will be in court here until we stop it.
Mm-hmm. Great to hear. Back to the redistricting issue, if I may. There's the four largest states with the largest number of seats at stake. Texas and California were the first two large states to go through this, and those, I think, are set past legal muster and all. And then there's Virginia and Florida, and Virginia is not going to redistrict, and they apparently screwed up on procedural grounds. So I have no idea if they had the option of not making that mistake. Whoops, here comes our first call. Let's take that, and then we'll go back to my question. Hello, caller. Hello, caller. You're live on the air. What's your first name, and from where are you calling?
Well, I'm calling from right outside the station. I was trying to drop something off here, like a CD.
we're in Talmadge.
Yeah, we're in Talmadge. You're probably in Philo, I imagine.
Oh, I'm in Philo. Yeah, but the door's locked.
Yeah, and no staffing it right. So I'm sorry. I apologize. Have to be another day then.
That's all right.
Okay.
There's no Dropbox or anything, huh?
No.
Sorry to interrupt
your
show. Leave it at Boontberry's.
Yeah, that's right. They can, somebody can pick it up from there.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for the CD anyway.
Well, this is local radio, so things happen like they happen. So my question there was, is there any way Virginia could have done it right, or they just start too late? Because when they first passed this, there was an election already in progress, and the law requires them to start to pass a law like this twice, once before an election and once again after. And when they started, there was an election already in progress, and that was a procedural error. So do you have any idea if they could have done it right, or was it just that they're out of time?
My understanding is that it was too late, according to the Virginia Supreme Court ruling. You know, that's not to say that they couldn't do it again, right? You know, it is a procedural rule. They could, you know, take a run at this, not for 2026.
Yeah, not for 2026. Yeah.
They have choices going forward. It's not as though the Virginia Supreme Court said that the voters can't approve this kind of action, but that it has to be done according to how they interpreted those rules under the Virginia Constitution.
Okay. And my last question might be about Florida then. It takes us to Florida. There's four seats at stake. And this one is still in progress right now. I mean, it only occurred a few weeks ago. But the legal issue is unique, I believe. And the legal issue is that there is a law in Virginia. It's called the Fair Districts Amendment that requires the districts be drawn in a more fair way than their legislature just voted to do just a few weeks ago. Now, in this case, it's the legal issue, I believe, is that can the legislature trump a vote of the people? By the way, that Fair Districts Amendment was voted by the people at an election statewide in Florida. So, what's your two cents worth on that issue?
And we are getting really short of time.
We just have a couple minutes to go.
Yeah. Let me just say, it's really simple. That voter referendum created a rule in the Florida Constitution.
Yes. Okay.
And so a statute and an act of the legislature cannot void a constitutional provision. That's kind of how our kind of structure works. Constitutions are above statutes. Uh-huh. So the answer is no. And I think Florida is one of those places where the voters got to say, enough is enough. We don't want partisan gerrymandering. They put that rule in their constitution. And if that constitution means anything, it has to be that this map has to go.
Well, okay. But it Florida Supreme Court, though, will have to say those words, which you expect them to do. But who knows what they'll come up with.
You know, we are litigating that case right now.
Great.
So, you know, we will be fighting it in the courts. But it is hard to understand what meaning that amendment to the Constitution could have, except for to bar kind of blatant partisan gerrymandering, especially when it's mid-cycle like this and there's just no other reason for redistricting at all.
So we're running out of time, and I didn't have a chance to ask about the threat to birthright citizenship. No. Maybe we can have you back again.
There you go.
Yes, I'd be happy to come back and talk to you some other time.
Sure, 30
seconds.
We are
going to hear from the Supreme Court on birthright citizenship, but honestly, listeners can just read the 14th Amendment for themselves.
Yay, all right.
Okay, for information about Campaign Legal Center, that's it. www.campaignlegal.org online. Have a look there for numerous articles, many of which we didn't mention tonight, didn't have time to, but their activities for supporting voting rights. And Danielle Lang, thanks for being our guest this evening. This has been Corporations and Democracy. We're here on third Thursday, 7 to 8 p.m., back in 1 month. That'll be June 18th. Meanwhile, you can get more information about the things we discuss here at thealliancefordemocracy.org.